everyone, thank you so much for joining us again. It is a book club episode this week, and we're going to talk about Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Alice and I are extremely hyped to be joined by Emma and Grace, who are the editrices of Foul Play magazine, but they can tell you a bit about that themselves. Would you like to introduce yourselves? Emma?
I'm Emma.
And I'm Grace, and yeah, as you said, we are the founders of a new kind of true crime magazine. It's called Foul Play. It is the first ever high-end, quarterly, non-sensational true crime magazine.
That is cool.
We think it is anyway, we're pretty sure.
Okay. We've done lots of Googles.
Yeah. So the idea is that we are trying to make something that can prove that true crime can be beautiful, that it can be non-sensational, that you can actively, you know, enjoy true crime in a kind of responsible way. There are other true crime magazines that do exist, but we feel like they're trying to do a bit of a different thing. We're also, as part of it, plugging kind of the new wave of contemporary true crime literature, podcast, films, etc. So we're very excited to be talking about this book.
Cool. We're very excited to have you, aren't we, Alice?
We're so excited because everything you've just described is so our bag.
Yeah.
We love crimes, and but we like responsible, ethical consumption of crimes.
Yeah. So if you are like a relatively new joiner to this podcast, may I recommend you go back to episode 2, which was contemporary true crime. And it banged. That was like a great episode that we did, and I do not feel any qualms in recommending you listen to it.
I can't believe you didn't pluralize crimes.
True crimes.
True crimes. It is a really good episode.
Oh, thank you.
All the books you mentioned are really good. I mean, Fact of a Body.
Yeah.
The Adversary. I think yes. As well.
The Red Parts.
The Red Parts. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, enough about all of us. So I'll Be Gone in the Dark. You all know this because you should not be listening to this episode if you do not know the content of this book. You should probably have read it, but if you haven't and you still want to listen, it is written by Michelle McNamara, who unfortunately died before the book was published, but her kind of adult life's work was trying to track down and identify a man who perpetrated a string of rapes and murders in California over many, many, many years. And yeah, this book is just about those crimes and her attempts to identify the dude what done it. So, Alice, kick it off.
Well, one of the things that I really liked about this book, and something that I like about the kind of true crime that I imbibe in general, is the personal element, that it has that kind of thread of her biography in it as well, mm-hmm. which I really dug.
I dug it too. Did you dug it?
Yeah. We're both big fans.
I think that there's, like you said, at the heart of lots of really good true crime books is the author's obsession. So her kind of obsessive hunt to find the killer. And it is about her, of course. And yeah, I just think it's brilliant. I think we were talking about this just before we got here. There's one really brilliant bit, which is actually in the kind of foreword by Gillian Flynn, where she sums it up, which is where she says that if you are going to actively consume...
It's sorry, charging, isn't it?
If you're going to be actively choosing to be a consumer of someone else's tragedy, then make it good. So
yeah.
About Michelle McNamara kind of oozing with empathy, everything she writes with humanity, and that's kind of so key throughout the book. When she talks about the victim, she really paints a picture of their lives, what they might be feeling, what they might be thinking.
Yeah, I think that's what I found was really striking, was you learn a lot about the victims. And I think that operates as like an interesting, you know, I'm interested in people's lives, but it obviously acts really in contrast with how little you know about the person. The person who did it, we don't know anything about in this book.
Mm.
So yeah, it's almost like you know so much about the victims and you know almost nothing about the person that did it.
Which is the total opposite of, like, Making a Murderer, which I feel kicked off the recent kind of mainstream true crime.
It's so true.
I really like the fact that it was just that it was published anyway, that they kind of used... I mean, it was obviously a complete tragedy what happened to Michelle, and lots of books would then just not go forward, but they used her community in order to publish it anyway, and that really speaks to her kind of community spirit anyway, and her attitude to the whole way that she was going about her research, because she talks about not caring who catches him,
just
someone catches him. And it was kind of like, I almost feel like she would feel like she doesn't care who publishes the book as long as it's published.
Yeah.
So I think that the publisher and Patton and Gillian managed to stay really true to her.
Yeah, there's a really interesting companion piece to this. I don't know if you guys have heard it. It's the I'll Be Gone in the Dark podcast.
Ooh.
And yeah, it's really good. I think it's three parts and it is about the book. So it's very much about the book, how it became to be published, what happened, and it's got some really interesting people talking on it. So Patton Oswalt talks, I think Paul Haynes and Billy Jensen, who helped her finish the book, also talk, and then also her editor and her agent. So it's about the process from, you know, her editor talks about how when they acquired the book, she thought that they were, you know, this was going to be the start of a kind of illustrious writing career. And it's really interesting, especially if you work in publishing, you know how kind of publishing works, the kind of process that it went from being an LA Magazine article, the original article, it was like a 7,000 word article on the Golden State Killer, to being this book. It's really, really interesting, and obviously she died with it unfinished, and their kind of process to getting it finished.
That's really cool. I didn't know that it existed. I didn't know this podcast existed.
Me neither. And I was about to ask if you guys knew the publication story, because obviously her researchers fill in a lot of the gaps.
Yeah.
And I wondered, I mean, it's such incredible timing that the book came out, a month before he's caught?
Well, this is another really interesting question. So I think with this, I remember when I finished it and we spoke, people were like, this could actually lead to them finding him. So I think that all of us have read it before the plot twist.
I was midway through.
Okay.
And then I was in this strange situation where I was like kind of trying to avoid reading articles about it as though I was avoiding spoilers. But I already knew in the process of reading the book that it's never caught, so it didn't really fucking matter.
Should we explain that?
Yeah.
So, shortly after this book was published, I think this book was published in February of this year, maybe. They arrested someone after 40 years, Joseph James D'Angelo, his name is, and it's kind of made, I mean, it's made the book explode, really. I mean, I think it was doing quite well anyway, but I, for one, read it without knowing who he was. He has been charged with kind of a variety of murders throughout, because it happened over 20 years in lots of different places in California, and the person that they've now arrested is going to, it's just absolutely crazy. So I think having read it before is probably now a different experience to if you read it afterwards.
Yeah,
and they will reissue it.
The next run, apparently. So it sold out everywhere in Italy, obviously, but apparently at the next print run, they're working on a kind of final chapter.
Yeah.
But does anyone know why he stopped? Did he stop? Did he move?
There's a theory about the fact that he had children. That was maybe the explanation for the gaps, because there are a few gaps in the crime sprees that relate to the birth of his two children, I think.
He was really active. Should we explain a little bit about the crimes as well? So he was really active between the 70s and 80s, and he stops around 1986, around then, which is around the time that he had his, I think, second or third child. So no one knows what happens to him after then, and people assumed that he died, right? So there were these different theories, and the thing with this is that there are so many different theories, and there are so many kind of sleuths that were working on this case, kind of with the police as well. So Michelle McNamara, obviously being one of them, they're kind of detectives, but they're like hardcore sleuths, like the community around it on Reddit and all these other places, kind of trying to find out what happened. They have people, and then they go through all the data, and then it wouldn't work, and it's just absolutely crazy. There were lots of people kind of looking for him.
In terms of why he stopped, I don't think.
No one knows yet.
But
we might find out.
Exactly. Like, there's this there's a Reddit thread that Eirons. So one of the most important things I think that Michelle McNamara came out with this book is that she like rebranded him basically as the Golden State Killer, which was something much more palatable than Eirons, which is East Area Rapist / Original Night Stalker.
Which is something that I actually found a bit confusing when I was reading the book.
I did too. So I read this when I was travelling to Australia, and I found the first few chapters a bit confusing.
Yeah.
Thought it was just because I was like crazy on plain jet lag, and then kind of just plowed through, and then after about the first quarter was like, oh okay, I'm with it. But then actually we had a conversation today, I realised actually it was kind of by design, all these loose threads that don't really make any sense, because that's exactly how it was to the police. And then,
yeah, like, is it the same person?
Yeah,
like,
I think
you're reading it and you're like, is the murderer the same person as the rapist?
Yeah.
Like,
it's very
which I suppose was always going to be inevitable with a story like this, when there were so many crimes, it took them so long to work out that it was all one person anyway. And the nature of true crime is you always kind of start at the end and go back to the beginning, and it can never really be truly linear.
But my favourite books are always the ones that give you an experience, and I feel like she did do an excellent job there of giving you the experience of not really understanding what's happening, giving you a taste of that, and then being like, oh, and here's actually the developments that have been made.
Something I found really interesting with this book was, and obviously I don't know if this is 100% true, or, you know, if there are other people who have different opinions on it, but I found that so much of the true crime that I've read and the podcast that I listen to, the stories are so characterised by the police's negligence or misconduct or failings, and this seemed a rare example of, like, actually quite competent and dedicated investigation that just, unfortunately, for whatever reason, did not pan out. But yeah, I found that really unusual, was reading a book where it wasn't like, and he got away again because of those idiot cops.
Well, they did kind of fail to communicate between jurisdictions, between jurisdictions. So I think that was like the only
this
is something that came up in the press conference that was given on the day that they announced his arrest, was that a lot of that was restricted by state legislation. And so actually it wasn't necessarily a failing of the police force, it was a failing of the democratic system and the way that local legislatures were dealing with the funding of being able to create these big databases, and how far behind certain areas were.
There's another thing as well, I think, going from now to, you know, what we, reading it initially to what we know now, is that I agree with you that it feels like the police were, like, really on top of it. But what I find now that's bizarre is that the guy who they found out, who they've arrested, like, so many of the theories are true, but he was on none of the lists.
That's what I find so interesting. Why was he not on anyone's radar?
Yeah, so he lived in Sacramento for like the whole time. He was a policeman.
He had a link to a crane company.
So all of their theories. Also, he was fired from the police for shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. Like, so it's when you look back now, because I agree with you, like, and I don't know, like, how much of that is true or not, but I do wonder, like, how could he have not been on any of the lists?
Yeah,
and
one of the things in the books is, like, they ask how on earth he's getting around all the dogs.
That was one of the bits that... And also, so true crime, I find that, like, I always find it harrowing lots of the time, but I'm never, like, not very often actively scared. Mm-hmm. I read this book, I took it to my parents' house to read it, and stayed on the ground floor, surrounded by countryside, and couldn't sleep. Like, it's one of the first times a true crime book has
struck fear into your heart.
And that's because of so many of the elements are absolutely terrifying. So that thing which they now found out is probably dog repellent, I found it really eerie when they said that he was going and feeding dogs or whatever, so they weren't barking. But he was going into houses, like, weeks beforehand, moving stuff. There's a bit in the book where this woman lifts up a sofa cushion and then sees the ligatures that he's already put there.
I don't remember that bit.
Yeah. Aww. I remember. They were talking about it on the podcast. And the idea where one of the bits that's really horrible is the idea that you wouldn't know he's in the house, then all of a sudden you just hear something. So this woman's doing the washing up, and then all of a sudden she hears something in her ear. And the bit with the phone call.
Yeah. We played before.
So there's a bit at the beginning of the book where he was tormenting victims years later. So 2001.
So that's like 40 years. Like it was
40 years later. He called up one of the victims and said something which was like,
"Do you remember when we played?"
Yeah, do you remember when we played tricks? And then when she was a child, when she was something like six, he was attacking her mum and dad and said something like, "Oh, do you want to come and see what I'm playing tricks with your mum and dad? Come and see." And all those years later. So when you think about the fact that that guy's just been in the.
And I think
terrifying.
That's almost what means that it kind of makes sense that he didn't get caught for such a long time, is that there is just such a level of, like, attention to detail in everything in the book. Like, he really worked hard at being a rapist and a murderer. Like, he really put in that hours.
Yeah,
professionalised
that.
There's a really interesting tweet today from Billy Jensen, who's been, like, really good on the Twitters. And he tweeted this aerial view of the house, and he said that it's really interesting that he'd set up his house with no trees around the kind of perimeter, no shady places where people could hide. So it's like he had set up his home to protect from someone like him.
See, that's I think that I agree. That's one of the things about this book that makes it so different, is that it really unsettled me. And like, I just moved into a ground floor flat. I have quite a nervous disposition. And what I found so chilling is that the description of all of the signs that people saw and ignored. Because if you're nervous, you see things, you're like, I did not leave that like that. And you know that you did, or you know that there's a harmless explanation. But the scenario in which there is not a harmless explanation, the scenario in which the explanation is, in fact, incredibly harmful, is so terrifying to me. That and the moon face. The description of his moon face in the
moon
dark.
Moon face?
You don't remember that? When, like, the guy's waiting for his girlfriend and he sees the dude, like, drop to the ground.
Yeah.
Do, like,
oh, and do the roll.
And
yeah.
he personifies him as, like, having a big baby moon face.
But I think that just shows Michelle's skill as a writer, that she managed to tread that line of really getting readers to understand the seriousness of his crimes and what a huge undertaking it was in terms of, yeah, like, how much effort he had to go to do all this, but without being sensational and distasteful. Because she doesn't, like, wallow in the kind of really, you know, the actual brutal bits. She just sets it up and lets your imagination kind of take that next step in understanding how horrific it must have been for the victims. I just think that's an incredible line to have trodden.
It feels like maybe that lack of a culprit in her lifetime was probably quite good for... obviously, I believe she is a responsible writer anyway, but I feel like not having a culprit to kind of psychologize and go deep in their backstory, and like, I don't know, I think maybe that was quite good for turning it into a quite responsibly written book. And it did mean that she had to focus on the victims, and yeah, I feel like you know a lot about these people, not just about their deaths but about their lives. And there's like long pages about this teenage girl and her relationship with her mom, and like, I don't know, I just feel like that's not super common in true crime.
Something we talked about before, in particular with the Amanda Knox case, don't we? The fact that it's called the Amanda Knox case and not...
The Meredith Kutcher thing.
But yeah, there's definitely a tendency to concentrate on the cult, person who committed the crime, the perpetrator of the crime, rather than the victims.
I think it's really nice as well. I think it's really interesting how she sets up why she became obsessed with this thing. So the kind of case where she talks about in her hometown, which made her become obsessed with, you know, go down this route of being obsessed with kind of cases and trying to find out what happened to people, and trying to track down kind of him. Basically, it leads on to why she got into it. So it is like the memoir threads through it, I think, really kind of important and make it feel a lot more human.
But I don't feel like it lingers on her shit too much. No, like, that's exactly really the right,
right amount of it. And also when it talks about her, kind of how she does it. So another bit where she, like, the picture of her where she's just, like, in her room, like, sleuthing or whatever. It just feels really, like, relatable.
And her, like, kids, like, play around.
But I do think that it's interesting that... So I haven't read this about I'll Be Gone in the Dark, but I know that the criticism that I came across of Fact of a Body was someone saying it was self-indulgent to use another, like a crime in order to tell your own story. But I feel like within the context of true crime writing, that there's something almost less indulgent about someone like Michelle McNamara, who, although she threads in a bit of her biography, she had no ego about the case.
No.
Whereas, like, the kind of your standard profile of a true crime writer is like Ethan Hawke in Sinister, you know, where he's like obsessed with it, but only because he wants his name on it. And he wants to be Truman Capote.
So true.
There's another really, sorry to keep talking about this podcast, but there's another
Which podcast are you on right now?
I know,
right? Let's show some loyalty.
There's another really interesting bit in the I'll Be Gone and Dark podcast where Patton Oswalt, I think it is speaking, and he's saying, he said to her something like, well, what happens if they find him while you're still writing it? And she was like, well, I'll scrap the book, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, as long as they find him, then that's all that matters. Which, yeah, it's like the heart's in the right place. It's, and I feel, I mean, this is a question that we might never know, but I feel personally that without this amount of, I don't know, like, it's hard to say with what we know now is obviously patchy around what's going to come out with the case. It feels like this must have had some say in them finding him. I don't know.
I mean, at the like absolute minimum, you can say it raised awareness.
It raised awareness. And I think that Golden State Killer package is so much easier for people to ingest than this Eron's thing. And now it's wild that there is another thing, the Vasilia ransacker. So there's, like, more things that have come out.
There's another serial killer that they think he was.
Serial killer, yeah. Serial killer.
Oh, he's another person too?
Yeah, it's three people in one.
But they had, this is how wild it was, in that period in California, they had something like 5 serial rapists and 2 night stalkers. They had to call him the original night stalker because of Richard Ramirez. Mm-hmm. So absolutely wild.
A bad time to be a Californian.
Mm. Yeah, but something else that's really interesting is that they found him through a method that is suggested in the book. So the familial DNA thing.
Has that been confirmed?
I don't know, it's on the Reddit. Okay. I think it's confirmed. It's really hard to say.
They said they were using new and innovative techniques.
So in the book, obviously, Michelle suggests that one of the ways they could find him is through these genealogy websites where people upload their own DNA, and obviously they've got, like, such good DNA matches for him in lots of other things. And from what I read, it was a fourth cousin, and then they had a group of people that they saw were a match, and then it was just a case of waiting until they could get a hold on his DNA and test it. But I think that's really interesting that it was solved, we think, in a way that is suggested in the book.
And she does mention in the book as well, doesn't she, that in a list of possible professions, she does mention he could be a cop.
Yeah,
I know. And so many of the... So many of the things that they believed were true. I mean, I have to admit, I didn't know much about the case before reading this. I'd heard about Eron, say, so I don't know how much was, like, on Reddit before and stuff, but they had, like, files, they would keep finding people, and then something would go wrong. And then the obsessive thing about in the book as well, it starts with her, because he stole things from people's houses, she finds those cufflinks on the internet and buys them, thinking that she's found him, and then it's another dead end, and it's another kind of... They're like proper data mining. And
her,
like,
perseverance was incredible.
Yeah, like really dogged, kind of obsessive. That's what's the best thing about true crime people, that they're always a little bit obsessive.
Yeah, and that's the thing I find really, like, unrelatable, is, like, I'm so lazy, and I cannot imagine pouring this much effort into something that... realistically, I would just assume I did not have the power to solve. Whereas she clearly believed that, like, she was one of many people that, if they worked together, could fix it.
Yeah.
Did she have any other cases that she was interested in, or was she really just...
That's a really good question. I don't know. So, I do wonder, they now talk about whether they can find the Zodiac killer through these means. Yeah,
everyone knows it's Ted Cruz anyway. Why bother?
I don't think they have a good enough DNA sample for him, do
they? Not. I'm not sure. I was reading some stuff about it.
Yeah, no, I don't know if she... It seemed, certainly the impression it gives in the book is that this was like her number one cause.
Mm.
But I think just, you know, the idea of her saying, I'll just scrap the book. Fuck it.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of almost implies like there were more books in her.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe not. Maybe she wasn't that fussed about
her. What's interesting again is that her editor is like, we didn't see her. I think that there's this thing when people are like, just a true crime writer or just whatever. I feel like with this book, hopefully, like, true crime as a genre, like, people are like, oh, it's really good for a true crime book or whatever. Whereas hopefully there'll be more books that prove that true crime as a genre can just be good in of itself. But her editor was like, I saw her not just as a true crime author, we saw her doing all sorts of writing. And when the book came in and we were acquiring it, everyone felt that she had such a strong voice. I think that that's something all the way through the book as well, like, her voice is so kind of strong and unique, and it does feel very much like, you know, kind of her voice and what she's saying.
Without it being like, I don't know, all about her.
Yeah, this is why I'm just saying it, she's an incredible writer.
She has such a distinctively intimate personal style without feeling like...
That's like humble and like...
But not in like a hashtag humble way.
Yeah, and not in one of those, you know who I'm talking about, like those kind of... comedy murder podcast people, you know, that kind of thing, like, it's not that, it's trying to tell a story in a way that people will resonate with people rather than like witty asides.
But I suppose because she did also have a purpose in writing this book, which was to try and get more people interested in it.
Exactly.
Yeah, which I guess is a very different purpose to lots of other
true crime vehicles.
Yeah,
I have a question. We talked about this briefly earlier. Do you think he's read it?
Ooh.
I, like, as soon as they found him, the first thing that me, I can't remember, one of my friends mentioned to me, they were like, do you reckon he's read the book? Because there's obviously that letter to an old man at the end.
Yeah.
Where she's like, and then they're going to, you know, I hope that someone's going to turn up at your drive and you'll realise that you're stuck and you're too old to climb over fences or whatever. There's that amazing
way to end the book,
and it's whether, so that was in the article first as well, but it was also in the book. And you think of someone generally, if you think that the profile of someone like this is that they're a big narcissist, and if they were comfortable to stay in that area for so long, would they have, I don't know, I'm obsessed with this question.
The fact that he made that phone call all those years later,
right,
says to me that he is still like thinking about his
own importance and significance in people's lives.
Exactly.
I would be surprised if he didn't read it just to like marvel at how clever he had been,
which is what makes now the fact that like they found him book just so much. I'm excited to reread it. We were talking about when we reread it, whether we reread it after like more stuff comes out, or you reread it now, and
I'm just gonna reread it
over and over again every week with more.
I'm gonna wait until I after the trial because I want to know all the details.
I want to wait for that the reprint with
the
extra chapter. Yeah. Or maybe they'll just write a second book. I mean,
because after the trial, they'll probably be in
the researchers.
There's gonna be an HBO thing.
Oh really? As presented as fiction or non-fiction?
I'm really not sure. I saw that they got the rights for it, or
I hope they do it nicely.
I think that they will. I mean, it's just absolutely wild, I think, that they were able to bring this case to a close so soon after a book like this. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that this is going to do for true crime what other kind of things have done. So, like, if you say, like, podcasts, like Serial or whatever, like, bringing it into... What we're trying to do with the magazine equivalent... Mm-hmm. I feel like this is going to do it with books, and that people will start looking at true crime books kind of maybe more seriously, or feeling like, I feel like this is the first good example of, like, it's probably not the first example ever, but for me, like, big mainstream example of true crime being a force for good.
Yeah.
So, like...
Not just, like, a personal catharsis or, like, a... Which is obviously a noble reason to write a book, and, you know, something like The Red Parts. but like it literally served a social purpose.
Yeah.
As well as like a personal one and like a healing one. It's like it did a thing that no one had been able to do.
Yeah, which is why I think it's absolutely massive. And I think that, you know, people always say like In Cold Blood is the true crime book. I feel like I want this to become the, like, the I'll Be Gone in the Dark, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The,
like the benchmark.
Genre-defining yeah. benchmark that when people say this is going to be the next or this is, you know...
Yeah,
I was thinking that.
Well, it certainly looks like sales-wise, it is truly breaking into the mainstream. Which, even though we have our like beloved favourites of the genre from the last like couple of years, I mean, the Red Parts obviously did well because it's Maggie Nelson, mm-hmm. but it didn't break into the mainstream. You couldn't go pick that up in Smiths, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, I think, very well could be, and it helps that Gillian Flynn's name is on the cover
and Stephen King's endorsement.
Oh, he's on everything. Yeah. God love him.
Yeah, as soon as I saw on the cover of this one, it says, I loved this book, and I was like, I feel like I've seen that on a tube poster this morning for a different book.
Yeah, it's, I think it's going to be an important book, hopefully, but also the thing is that it's very much a true crime genre book, like, if that's the thing, so it's very much, like, talking about true crime as a genre, like, throughout the Gillian Flynn thing, where she literally talks about, if you're going to consume true crime, if you're going to, it's not just a non-fiction book that's about crime, it's a...
It knows that it's in the lineage of true crime.
Yeah, and so, also it couldn't be misshelved in biography, which I feel yeah. that the fact of a body and the Red Parts certainly
could.
That's
true, actually, yeah, I haven't
thought about that. So it feels like it's a, hopefully there'll be more kind of books like this to follow. I mean, I would like it too, but...
So what would you... You're good people to ask this... What would you recommend to people that like this book? Obviously, my choice would be Fact of a Body.
Yeah, I would say that.
Which is,
we've talked about extensively on the contemporary true crime episode, Fact of a Body by Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, which was one of my favourite books of last year.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I worked for the publisher that published that, but I came across it before I was a twinkle in Pamela's eye in 2017. And absolutely adored
yeah.
it.
I did not shut up about that.
I didn't
shut up.
No.
This is how I feel about it.
Yeah, we reviewed it in issue one of Foul Play. I just think it's an outstanding piece of... Yeah, it's true crime, slightly different, obviously, but it's just so well done, I think. And a real page-turner, which is... And it's not the kind of true crime book, which is just like... And then this horrible thing happened. These are like details about cases. It's like one of the first true crime books I remember reading, Happy Like Murderers, you know, the Fred and Rose West one, Record of Birds. I mean, it's an amazing book, but it is just absolutely horrendous. And there is a thing in true crime where it's like no details spared. In things like Fact of the Body, I just think, well handled. It's obviously super, super harrowing, and it's a book about abuse. But I just thought it was really well kind of woven, like it's narrative, mm-hmm. non-fiction. Also, these are all the books that you've already talked about, but I thought The Adversary was amazing, recent true crime book.
By Emmanuel Carrère.
Emmanuel Carrère, yeah, the one about the guy who was just living a complete...
Fake life,
but it's...
We reviewed that one as well.
We did review that one as well. I am a very big fan of You Could Do Something Amazing With Your Life, You Are Ral Note. Basically, it's written by a guy called Andrew Hankinson, who is a journalist from Newcastle, and it is about Ral Note. But it's very... It's kind of really interestingly written. It's in like a second-person narrative, as if you are Ral Note, so it's like you're inside his head. And it goes from his release from prison in 2010 to like 10 days later when he died, and that kind of crazy like hysteria that followed, which is something we don't see very often, I don't think, in the UK. But also, it's really interestingly done because it's really claustrophobic, so you only know what Ral Note saw and did. So like the kind of when Gaza turned up with a chicken or whatever, he didn't know that that happened, so that's not in it. The fact that there was like a Facebook page called like Ral Note You Legend or whatever, he didn't know it existed, so it wasn't in there. But also, it's kind of like being in the mind of a crazy person, basically, and it's really kind of claustrophobic and harrowing. And I just think it's really inventive and done really well.
I look forward to reading it.
Somehow that whole story completely passed me by.
Oh, yeah, because I was talking
about it. I had this really surreal... Were you there in the pub that time when... I think I was with our friends Jenny and Dan, and they kept saying Ramo. And if you don't know that name, I was like, I'm really sorry. What are you talking
what
about?
What words are you saying?
And they were both just horrified. They were like, but it was all over the internet. Like,
exactly
you live.
The same. I still haven't read it. So.
But I remember, like, vividly it being warm and, like, it just being on TV and stuff like that not happening in the UK. It was like an American.
No, it wasn't even so much that it was like an American thing. It was like a thing that a thriller writer would put in a book, and you read it and you're like, yeah, but that doesn't really happen. Like, I get why you're doing it for the dramas, but like,
And it's about, like, it's called, like, toxic masculinity and,
the weirdness of, like, a live manhunt. Like, a thing that was happening in real time on television.
Yeah, exactly.
For, like, a dangerous person.
Yeah, you feel like you're in, and then you want to instantly read something else, which is completely, but it's, like, really, really good, I think.
Emma, got any faves that you want to big up?
You just said them all. Hello.
Well, this is the thing that it feels like there aren't that many good true crime books being. Not like there aren't many good ones, but they're just. It's like crime fiction is massive. There are so many books being kind of published, whereas we've got some real keen fave, but.
Yeah, I haven't. And also because with the magazine, I've been in charge of the podcast reviews. I've been listening to podcasts lately rather than books, so I have read *I'll Be Gone in the Dark* and *Fact of a Body*.
Yeah,
but I haven't really. Yeah, I need *Roundabout* next on my to-do list. So,
well, given that I feel like if you listen to this podcast, you probably also like other podcasts, and if you're listening to this episode, you probably like listening to crimes. What are some true crime podcasts that you would recommend to the listeners of this show?
Absolute favourite at the moment. It's finished now, but the season of *Missing and Murdered*. Cleo, and that's a story about not just about one particular person going missing, but it also puts in context of the 60s sweep where tons of Native American children were just taken from their homes with very little reasoning, at a much lower, like, tolerance bar than modern Americans, and kind of the impact that had on this whole family, who were all, I think it was 5 or 6 siblings, were all spread across America and Canada, taken from their reservation, and then not given any information about where any of the other children were, and one of them died when she was 13, and it's about them trying, these siblings coming back together and trying to unravel kind of what actually happened, why they were split up, what happened to their sibling, because at that they didn't really even know if she actually was dead. They hadn't had a formal, they didn't know where her grave was, they didn't know anything. And so just this reporter kind of helping them unpick all of that. I think that does what, like the kind of books that we've been talking about do, in that it's not just about this one particular crime, it's about this wider impact and something a bit bigger.
Yeah, so I think that's a really big thing as well. So, like, with the magazine, with the first issue, like, someone we know wrote an article about Howard Shipman, basically. So,
do you remember him, Alice?
I remember Harold Shipman.
How could I forget?
Yeah. Which, there's a second part, actually, a follow-up, but it directly affected kind of her family. And she wrote an article, but what she's done is she's written an article about the impact of it on a town, like, the impact that it has on the community. Because the other thing that I think that in true crime in general is that there's already been, like, so much done about the same old, like, big hitters. Do you know what I mean? Like, people like Ted Bundy or Harold Shipman or whatever, and it's just the same kind of stuff over again, whereas it's actually more interesting to read about the impact on the people that it affected, when there's already so much published, especially, like, with the design of the magazine, like, we haven't used, like, any pictures of serial killers or whatever, because you just don't, like...
I know what Harold Shipman looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just really important to use what has been a terrible thing to some purpose. So, like, this book really highlights the need for combined databases and the legislation that needs to come with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Missing and Murdered highlights the fact that there needs to be huge reform in the way that siblings are kind of the priority that they're given in being allowed to access their own historical data. And so just, the books that I like are the ones that serve a purpose aside from, like you say, they're not self-indulgent.
There's another really good podcast called Behind True Crime, It's so the girl who wrote the Michelle McNamara article. So we went to press the day before they found him with issue 2 of the magazine.
This is literally the worst thing I've ever heard.
So we have
our magazine WhatsApp.
So we have a review of Are We Gone in the Dark and a feature, which is somewhat update. We got some inserts made. Why was I telling you this? So there's a girl, her name's CWS, and she works for, and there's a true crime subscription world behind True Crime, but basically she runs a podcast for them called Behind True Crime, and she interviews like people that are doing true crime ventures, but kind of like responsible true crime ventures. There's a really good episode with Billy Jensen and Paul Haynes talking about like how they finished the book, but she talks to all sorts of people. It's really, really interesting, who are kind of doing interesting things with true crime.
That's cool. That's like a meta crime.
Yeah, true crime industry.
Podcast about true crime. Not a true crime podcast.
Do you guys have any true crime podcasts that you listen
to? I love In the Dark. Like, that's my fave true crime podcast. I thought the first season was... That's a chef's kiss emoji. And the second season is underway now, and I think it's just so interesting. I cannot wait to listen to the rest of this series. I love In the Dark. You got any books that you would like to, books or podcasts, Alice, that you want to...
Book-wise, so I do think the other side of true crime, so we've got like the stuff like I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is like a kind of new genre. We have the sensationalist stuff that's generally kind of vile. Then there's also the stuff that's a little bit more practical and informative, which I also enjoy reading.
Forensics by Val McDermid.
Yes, Forensics by Val McDermid is a great book. It's written basically to just explain how certain procedures and things work. So it's kind of like a forensics guide for writers. But she interviews people in the industry. She writes about examples of crimes in which certain technologies have been used to solve them. It's a really interesting book, and it can give a bit of an insight into where the kind of history of forensics, like where a lot of the stuff that we take for granted has actually come from. So I love that one. And then my other fav, although I should say I haven't reread this since I became more kind of ethical in the kind of true crime I've read, so it does need a revisit, but there's a book called 40 Years of Murder by Professor Keith Simpson, and he was a pathologist in London, and he was involved in a lot of the early kind of forensic work that, you know, we still use today. And it's just basically a memoir, but chapter by chapter. It's like a memoir of his career. For example, he was the pathologist who helped find the acid bath murderer.
With that tiny little
fragment. Yeah, he found a kidney stone in the guy's front garden. Keith Simpson, quite the man.
Was that in like Muswell Hill?
That was in Muswell Hill. And he just died.
What? Oh, cool.
Yeah, what was his name now?
Yeah, because I was like boning someone who lived really near there.
Yeah, dude, it was around there. Famously, he was saying, like, as he was being arrested, his name is Dennis Nielsen. As he was being arrested,
he was saying,
so he was saying, like, you will never be able to pin this on me because there is no evidence. What and Keith Simpson was like,
I think the fuck not.
I think not, bitch.
Dennis Nielsen.
Yeah,
I know this case, and now I'm trying to remember what
Dennis Nielsen is. Yeah, he was. He killed gay men in the...
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm trying to... Maybe it was Generation Y that I heard.
I'm not sure, but there's we have this amazing... Someone at work told me this amazing story about him that basically he... We really wanted to do a feature on it, but we can't really... We're trying to find a natural source to come up. So basically he worked for the council, so he's obsessed with planning permission. So when he went to Dennis Nielsen.
Not your friend,
So when he was in prison, they would keep trying to redo bits of the prison, but because it was a grade 2 listed building, he'd be like, I think you're fine.
Which is like planning objection.
Yeah, but it's like perfect because it shows like these serial killers, they're not these like sexy, interesting thing, they're just like anoraks who are obsessed with planning permission. Do you know what I mean?
And also not killing people.
And killing, exactly.
That's something Michelle talks about in the book, is that she says that when you're unmasked, you lose your interest. That the whole, one of the worst things about him was the fact that he retains this mystery.
The mystique.
The mystique.
Yeah.
of being the Golden State Killer, but once he's found, all of that will just crumble and he'll lose his power.
Yeah. He'll just be a guy. He'll be a guy with a life and a story.
Like that, I mean, obviously the book title, but the bit where he whispers in someone's ear or whatever, the "You'll be silent forever and I'll be gone in the dark," like that kind of stuff sounds like he's like this really interesting type of guy. And then you see the picture of the guy now and you're just like,
it's just a bloke.
Yeah, just a bloke.
But then that's why Jack the Ripper is
an enduring
people's their imagination so much, because that is a mystery that will never be solved.
Yeah. Emma did her dissertation on Jack the Ripper.
Oh my god, did you?
About newspaper responses to Jack the Ripper.
We're gonna have a good chat.
Speaking of which, I am getting hungry. So we're going to go and talk about crimes over pizza. But before we go, I want to give you two an opportunity to big up your publication. How can people get it? Where can they follow you on the internet, personally and for Foul Play? Tell us everything.
Okay, so Foul Play issue, we've completely set up issue one, but issue two is available. You can order a copy at www.foulplaymag.com. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter. It's at foulplaymag. Yeah, so we're also stocked in Mag Culture in East London. We're looking for...
You can get issue one there, actually.
There's a few copies of issue one left still in the world in Mag Culture in East London. But yeah.
If someone by chance is listening who stocks magazine somewhere, this could be a good one.
It is really cool.
You can email Emma at foulplaymag.
Yeah, exactly.
Dot what?
Dot com.
So if people want to get in touch with you on Twitter, you're at foulplaymag.
At foulplaymag, or my personal one is at graceharrison55.
Cool.
Yeah, the 55th one. But yeah, so get in touch if anyone wants, if anyone's interested in, if anyone has any good books.
Yeah.
Obviously, if any publishers who are publishing some...
some juicy crimes.
Some juicy crimes, but non-sensational, contemporary, the drill.
Yeah, read the magazine first.
You are kind of looking for contributors, so if there's someone who's listening who's like, these sound like cool ladies I want to get involved with, then I have a story to tell.
If you have a story to tell that you'd like to share.
We're always
interested. We do also, actually, this would be a good time to plug our confessions page in the magazine.
Is it crimes you've done?
So the first one we pulled from online, but we would really love it.
If people actually...
And they can be, low-level crimes. Like, it doesn't have to be...
I killed a man.
Ideally, they would be low-level crimes.
We don't really want to be publishing. You're like...
They're not like...
An example is, when I was in school, there was a girl, so this is what I imagine she would confess. A girl in my school who was arrested for smoking weed, and it actually turned out that she was smoking lavender.
That's too sad.
So the other final thing, is that we are launching a true crime book club.
Ooh!
Can we come?
Yes, please.
Is it a live action book club, or is it?
I think that's real life.
It's in me space.
IRL true crime book club, where we can't believe it doesn't exist. This is like the thing with the magazine. We're like, why doesn't this already exist? So we're going to make an real-life true crime book club, which we're potentially looking at a June date, but we can confirm.
Cool, thank you. So if you want to know about that, follow them, or follow us, because we will big that up too. We can be found at WhatPagePod on Twitter.
And on Instagram.
And also on Instagram. And speaking of the Twitter, you've got to listen up tomorrow, Tuesday, June the 5th at 7 p.m. Alice and I will be... smashing away on our keyboards, retweeting, chatting. I hope that the Foul Play ladder
will be all over it.
So it will be hashtag WPAYO dark. That is the hashtag we're using. And I would, I would suggest that you use the hashtag in the book club chats for spoilers anyway, but I think it's specifically important that you use it this time in case you are talking about things that people on your timeline do not want to read about. So, yeah. See you for the chat.
All right, ta-ra.
Pizza time. Bye. Bye.